It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day.
Lars.
Together, we can forge a new beginning for America.
The 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
Now, honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday evening. A piece of good news that we got today is that the U.S. Senate is going to stay in business 2 weeks longer this summer. Maybe they'll actually get some of the things done that American voters sent them back there to get done. And the latest hobby horse of the fake news media like CNN is the Donald Trump Jr. emails that the New York Times first wrote about. By the way, at the time the Times wrote about these emails, they had not been released at that point by Donald Trump Jr. So the New York Times was writing about emails and reporting on emails, the contents of which they had not seen. They had talked to people who had talked to people who had seen what was in the emails. And by the way, there's an excellent piece of analysis that I think I'll post on tonight's Facebook page by our friend James Robbins from U.S. News, who takes a look at what Donald Trump Jr. did and did not do in a meeting with a Russian lawyer, and whether or not he was well within his rights to have that meeting. It also suggests that if the Russians were trying to influence American elections using a washed-up tabloid reporter, who's now a publicist named Goldberg, to send information to Donald Trump Jr. and say, you should go to this meeting with this lawyer. She has some good dirt on Hillary Clinton that comes straight from the Russian government, that Donald Trump Jr. did not violate the law by doing that. As they like to say in politics, the cover-up is sometimes worse than the original action. And we'll take your phone calls and emails, too. That's what we do best here. It's the best conversation in talk journalism, and you're welcome to take part at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. And, of course, naysayers go to the head of the line, but you have to stick around for a few questions by yours truly. A brand-new ranking of the best types of states to live in has been released, and believe me, it's more red than it is blue. I'll tell you about one teen who's now facing second-degree robbery charges after stealing candy from a grocery store, but it's the video of her arrest. Remember, she's 14. The arrest and the apprehension by store security that has one community in an uproar. Up to 25,000 Chinese intelligence officers live in the United States. Is that one more reason to step up our national security and maybe be a little bit more careful about who we allow into the United States of America? Tomorrow is the day of action. Protests from tech companies who want to address the issues of net neutrality. I'll talk about what the average American needs to know on that. And President Trump is giving support to have the Olympics in the United States for 2021 or 2024. I'll tell you which cities want the bid. And please cast a vote in my quick poll. You'll find a brand new question posted every night on my website at LarsLarson.com. It's a movie decision, and the director is chosen for the role of a blind man in this new movie, a person who is not blind. And now, advocates for the disabled are saying that is an inappropriate choice. Should the role of a blind man in a new movie only be played by a non-blind actor or an actor who has that disability? In yesterday's quick poll, we asked you, should the British government be able to block a terminally ill child from coming to the United States? 12% of you said yes, they should be able to block it. 88% of you joined me in voting no on that. Charlie Gard should have the chance to have his life saved, if possible. His parents have raised the money. There are doctors in America that are willing to work with him to try to cure his ills. And yet, the British government has reserved the right to tell him, no, you have to die, because we've decided for you, not your parents. And anybody who thinks the government makes a better parent than real parents should probably move to Cuba, where that's actually the law. Anyway, welcome to the show. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's go first to Alabama, and Ed's on the line. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, thank you, Lars. Hey, I just want to mention something about the Don Jr. thing.
Yeah.
You know, average Americans that work for a living that don't write blogs and different things, we don't care about stuff like that. Bill Clinton said it best, who I'm not a fan of. hey, it's all about the economy, stupid. You know, the bottom line is things are going in the right direction. And what Don Jr. did is no different than me. I'm a high school football coach down in South Alabama. If a parent, I'm playing Team X this week, and a parent comes to me and says, hey, a parent of the team we're playing was talking about a trick play, blah, 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 they're going to run this week against us. You think I wouldn't go listen to that?
Of course you would.
It's all an advantage. There's nothing illegal about it, what he did or I did or would do. There's nothing illegal. It's just, Candace, it's called winning. And people who don't win that are losers, they don't understand that. And the average American who works for a living, they get it. That's all he was doing. Nothing was illegal. Nothing even happened. But, hey, if you could get dirt on the team you're playing and get a trick play or what defense are going to out in, by gosh, by golly, you'd go do it, especially for your dad.
Of course you would, especially when a lot of us think there is some dirt involving Hillary Clinton, and it involves that uranium deal with Russia, in which Russia ended up owning 20% of all American uranium production. Thanks for the call, Ed, and thanks for listening. Vladimir's on the line in Texas. Hey, Vladimir, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
It's good talk with you, Lars. You have good information about Clinton. Everyone knows Clinton is corrupt. So it's not. It's like water is wet and sky is blue. Why would Trump Jr. be so eager to find out, other than, as you say, uranium deal, which Hillary signed off on to give Russia control of a big percentage of the U.S. Uranium supply?
And a lot of us have been complaining about that uranium deal for a good long time. Now, I hold back from those people who say, well, this deal is still going on. That deal was determined years ago when she was Secretary of State. But I think there was a legitimate question to be asked about whether or not Hillary Clinton should have signed off on a deal that nobody could have imagined in the 60s, 70s, or 80s that we would eventually sell 20% of America's uranium production to the former Soviet Union. It's absolutely crazy, but she signed off on it, and she made a lot of money by doing it. By the way, I want to share this with you because I am a big admirer of James Robbins, who used to teach at the National Defense University and Marine Corps University and served as a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense in the George Bush administration. You've heard him on this program before. But I thought he made a very good point in a piece that he wrote for U.S. News about this. He says the latest hyperventilating from the anti-Trump crowd is over a chain of emails from June of last year between Donald Trump Jr. and music producer Rob Goldstone. That's the publicist. And he said Goldstone was acting as an intermediary to set up a meeting between Trump Jr. and a Russian lawyer. According to Goldstone, the purpose of the meeting would be to pass along very high-level information. Well, the problem is she didn't have any high-level information, and today she says she still doesn't have any high-level information. The situation became even murkier, writes Robbins, when it was revealed that the lawyer had hired an investigator from Fusion GPS, the Democrat opposition research firm that was behind the notorious Trump-Russia dossier. Can you see that the fix is in here? By the way, what's on your summer packing list as you travel this summer? Wallet, phone, ID and keys, and your Harry's razor. I'll tell you what. Have you ever forgotten your razor when you went on vacation? Harry's is part of your summer routine. It is for me, for certain. They have everything you need for a great shave. The travel bag, lotion with SPF, travel size products, and each set comes with their travel blade protector to protect your razor in transit. And that's absolutely fantastic. And Harry's is so confident you'll love their blades like I do. For years, they're giving you their trial set for free. Just cover the cost of shipping. The free trial set includes the handle, 5 precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade and rich lathering shave gel. It all comes together. It's worth about $20, and all you have to do is cover a few bucks in shipping. To get your free trial set, including a handle, blade, shave gel, and travel cover, go to harrys.com/Lars. That's harrys.com/Lars. Don't wait. Get started with Harry's today. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Honestly provocative talk at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You know, I love the summertime, but it means a lot more yard work, more chainsaw work, more blue smoke and all that. And it can also mean that as you get a little bit older like me, you have some more aches and pains. It comes from exercise and overexertion, aging, and just plain old everyday living. But one way to get rid of those aches and pains is Relief Factor. It's a 100% research-based formula created to help combat the root cause of all those aches and pains, and that, of course, is inflammation. George writes in from Ohio, "I'm an architect that still draws with a pencil. I'm also very active with my hands. Nothing seemed to help with the pain, and I don't want to take ibuprofen. I've heard about Relief Factor, so I decided to try it. It worked, and I haven't noticed any side effects." You know, I've had that same reaction from a lot of my friends and my coworkers, so I've helped them out with Relief Factor. And the way to get started is the three-week quick start. $19.95 works out to 95 cents a day, less than the cost of a cup of coffee. For pain relief, visit ReliefFactor.com. That's ReliefFactor.com, or call 800-500-8384. That's 800-500-8384. Glad to have you with me and glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You know, one of the issues that we have talked about literally for years on this program is net neutrality. That whole idea is not about doing what's best for you, but for the government and letting the government get involved in the gold mine that is the internet instead of leaving it to the private sector. Well, tomorrow, the largest tech companies in the country will take part in a so-called day of action protest to fight the FCC's reversal of the Obama-era rules on net neutrality. So I've asked Dr. Rosalind Layton to join me, a fellow at the Center for Communication, Media, and Information Technologies in Copenhagen, Denmark. Doctor, it's good to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time tonight.
Why, thank you.
Boy, I'll tell you what, we're having a tough time hearing you. That is a distant, distant line, isn't it? Doctor, are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah, unfortunately, that line is just, it is so weak, there is no way we can boost it up high enough. I'll tell you what, I'll let my producer work on that, but let me tell you about this. Recently, and this is from Forbes, Amazon, Netflix, and Mozilla have taken note of the success of astroturfing, and they're leveraging a stick-it-to-the-man ethos to advocate for internet regulation. Now, any of you who are conservatives or libertarians like me, I'm a conservative with a lot of libertarian tendencies. I don't buy this stuff that we're going to stick it to the man. They seem to think that the internet will be better if you inject more government controls, specifically so-called net neutrality. Well, the amendments that they made to the Communications Act, which allow the FCC to regulate broadband through price controls, as well as taxing consumers to raise money for the government, that somehow that's going to give you better service. Well, on July the 12th, tomorrow, they're going to stage a so-called day of action. They're going to display their protest both on and offline to try to pressure Congress and the FCC to give up the reversal of these FCC rules that were adopted during the Obama administration. But as Dr. Layton writes, make no mistake about their motives. Netflix has been able to leverage favorable internet connections. I'll tell you what, let's go jump back to Dr. Layton. Dr. Layton, sorry about that delay. It may be that the FCC doesn't want us to talk. How are you tonight?
I'm well, thank you.
Oh, that is so much better. So I want you to help me explain. I've been trying for the last couple of years to explain to folks what net neutrality is and why it is not a good idea to let the government get in and do regulation of an entity, the internet, that has been such a gold mine for both business, for individuals, for trade, and everything else. And now the government wants to get more involved in regulating it. Tell us why we should reject the idea of this day of action by the big players on the internet.
Well, absolutely. And it's great that you have a free-thinking audience. So, you know, there is a concept of an open internet. And actually, you know, most people embrace that. They like the idea that they should be able to see the content of their choice and get the services of their choice. But that also means that they should have the freedom of choice of how they want to buy broadband. If they want to be able to get a broadband for free, a connection for free, if someone else subsidizes it, an advertiser or whatever, there shouldn't be anything wrong with that. But the problem is that companies such as Netflix, just as you mentioned, they say that the internet should be free for them. So they have a policy called net neutrality, which just means that the end user, you and me, we have to pay for their bandwidth. We might never, ever be subscribers of Netflix, but we're going to have to pay for the infrastructure for Netflix to deliver its videos to everybody else. Now, if we had a free market, Netflix would have to pay something to use the roads the same way that we do, but they're able to put the full cost of what they're doing onto us. So what we want to have is a free market where all the people who use the Internet exchange in a, you know, transparent supply and demand kind of relationship that would allow the same freedoms that all the Internet companies get to enjoy. Your broadband provider, cable, whatever, should be able to offer you different kinds of prices and options. It's not defined by Washington bureaucrats, but it's defined by you as the consumer.
Then other than the big players like that, who actually likes this idea among consumers? Because I'm like you. I mean, I work in a technology business. I need to have fast Internet. I'm willing to pay for it. But if I were somebody who said, oh, Internet's not that important, I want to be able to get my email once a day or once a week, you know, people who are just casual users, they don't go on and do a lot of research and need high speeds, I'm happy to see a system that lets them pay less for slower speed and me pay more for higher speed. So other than the big players, are there any folks among consumer advocates who think this is a good deal for the consumer?
Well, you know, this is what we call this typical problem with gamers and grandmothers. You know, grandmothers would be some that don't have to have a lot of bandwidth, but they're actually paying more than they need to, whereas gamers who need a lot of bandwidth, they pay a lot less. So the typical, there is a sort of group, a cohort that likes these kind of rules. They tend to be, you know, males between the ages 18 to 35. They like to use a lot of high-definition video entertainment, which is fair enough. But they want it to be able to be given, you know, they want it at a lower price than what it's actually costs. But that means the rest of us have to pay a higher fee. Now, within the world, if you go on to the Day of Action, you'll see the variety of companies who support this. Typically, you'll see a large number of big Internet players, which, by the way, their networks are larger than any ISP in the world. They could subsume, you know, they're becoming the Internet themselves. And, you know, they want to be able to make sure that their price is zero so that our broadband prices are higher, so that we're kind of subsidizing. This is kind of what we call corporate welfare.
Well, not only that, but I imagine those big companies want the government to take our tax money and go out and build the major pieces of infrastructure under the guise of extending service to everyone, when what they're really doing is just building major superhighways for the biggest users, and the average consumer doesn't really get much benefit out of it.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that's what I think that what you have to know about this campaign is they are calling for a very specific kind of regulation. It's called Title II from the Communications Act. It is the regulation that supported the Ma Bell monopoly for 50 years. It was a monopoly so bad that it took the Department of Justice to break it apart. The FCC and the Ma Bell over those years, they overcharged people for long distance. They didn't let anyone else attach a device to the network. You overpaid for your rotary phone and all of that stuff. Now, who in their right mind would want to put those kind of regulations on the Internet? Well, only the sort of people with a mind that they want to have one national broadband network, which is their goal, so that they can be able to have a kind of PBS over the Internet, control the media, control communications, and that's the end game.
Dr. Layton, I appreciate you taking the time. You can read the entire piece by Dr. Layton at Forbes magazine. Coming up in just a moment, your phone calls and your emails, and a new study from the Mercatus Center has determined the most and least fiscally sound states among the 50 United States. The results? Well, we'll tell you about them next, right here on The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. More honestly provocative talk right now on The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Glad to be with taking your phone calls, too, in just a moment. But Eileen Norcross joins me now, a senior research fellow with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and the co-author of Ranking the State's Fiscal Condition 2017. Ms. Norcross, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, those of us who live in American states with less than sound fiscal approach to handling their affairs get a little concerned when we hear about states like Illinois that are effectively bankrupt, and their solution always seems to be to raise taxes some more so that they can become even less fiscally sound. And you've published this study, so Let's start with the worst cases. Which are the worst states, worst run from a financial standpoint?
The worst runs from the bottom of the list are New Jersey, Illinois, this year Massachusetts, Kentucky. I'm going to throw in that bottom list Connecticut, even though it's done a little better this year on one front. But those are some of the states where you've got the worst fiscal conditions.
And what explains the fact that they would run themselves into these kind of fiscal ditches, if you will, while other states seem to do much better? Because I know that all these states like to spend our taxpayer money on belonging to organizations like the National Association of Counties, the National Association of Cities, and all the other similar ones, where you'd think they would get together every year and share, you know, their experience of, well, it works better if you do it this way. And yet the poorly run states never seem to learn those lessons.
Yeah, it really is. It is something they don't seem to learn the lessons. It's almost past dependent. They get on the wrong road and they just stick with it, even though it's going over a cliff. You see in those states that I named, in particular New Jersey, Illinois, Connecticut, these are states that have built up their debts and their pension liabilities over a period of decades. They have failed to fund them. They have issued debt to cover these pension liabilities. They have issued debt to cover the budget. They run into budget shortfalls and then engage in a lot of fiscal gimmickry, never really confronting these mounting obligations and never really getting any, the spending discipline isn't there consistently. And I think that's, they get there over a period of years.
By the way, you can find the report at Mercatus, mercatus.org/state-fiscal-rankings. I don't want to defend these states and their actions, but let me ask you something. Is it the case that given the kind of representative form of government we have, where you elect representatives to go to the state capitol and write the laws and create the policies, you elect governors, and that at some point when a state begins to get over that, financial cliff a little bit, maybe a toe over the cliff, the politicians that we put in charge of running these places say, well, gosh, if I do the right thing here, which is curb spending, drop taxes so that we can encourage more businesses to operate here and employ people and bring in more revenue, if I do that, they'll unelect me at the next election. So I'll vote for the wrong thing, which is kick the can down the road two or three terms. I'll get my terms in, and by the time anybody realizes they're on the way over the cliff altogether, I'll be long gone. With that kind of system, is there a way to reform it before one of those states hits the fiscal brick wall, I guess?
Yeah, I think it gets into the rules of the game, the rules that you put in place in states and through legislation, through constitutions that tie the hands of legislators and give them some discipline. And you can do that. If you put in a rule to control spending that encourages fiscal discipline, that spending only grows according to a certain rate, according to, let's say, population growth and inflation, you can put these rules into effect and you kind of bind the hands of legislators where they might be tempted to spend more or save too little. You can construct a rainy day fund where politicians have got to put money in according to a formula rather than according to discretion. So it really has to do with the design of these fiscal institutions and how good they are.
And yet the design is being done by the very people who fear that they're going to lose their political position if they vote for the thing that's more responsible. And if you say you can only spend this fast and you constantly have constituencies come to see you at the state capitol and say, but you have to fund my program. It's for the children. It's for the elderly. It's for, and all the causes are arguably good causes, I think, in most cases. But if you fund all of them, then you have to go over that fiscal line.
Right. I mean, it is a challenge. You have this concept of, the fox guarding the hen house, but you can still, I think, design a rule that's transparent, easy to evaluate. It should be something the public can easily, hold politicians to, and it's flexible. I mean, it's certainly true that sometimes voters may want to increase spending. So you want to be able to have, the voters decide ultimately what the priorities are for that state. So it's a combination of good rule design and, the public being able to evaluate the choices that politicians make in the light of those well-understood rules.
Let me ask you about one state that threw me off a little bit. You mentioned North Dakota. Now, my stepson used to live there a couple of years ago. He doesn't anymore with his family. But one of the things I was unimpressed with by North Dakota, most of what they've done has impressed me, is that when they went into the oil boom, which kind of tailed out a couple of years ago, and now it may be coming back a bit right now as prices come back up. But instead of saying we have this gusher of new revenue coming in, let's put a good chunk of it aside and not take on new obligations. They did what most people do when you get a raise. You spend as much as comes in your paycheck. And they didn't, or am I wrong about that? And because my understanding is, having visited the state a few times and reading the newspaper articles about what's going on locally, they say, well, gosh, we had all this money coming in during the oil, and we just thought it would come in forever, so we spent that way.
That's a great point. I'm glad you raise it. Yeah, although they're ranked number two, I would say, you know, don't look at the rank, look at the metrics. This is back in 2015 when they still had some, you know, they were pretty robust. They looked at that money and they said, hey, let's expand spending. They have a biennial budget there, and now 2 years later, they've got a gap. So how do you manage a windfall is really an important question for states that, you know, have that luxury of having these windfall revenues. And it's also, you know, another thing to look at there is oil a really good source of revenue to base your state spending on? This is a volatile source of revenue. You're going to have boom years. Alaska's gone through this now where, yeah, when the money's there, you know, yeah, you could build out spending, but is that spending supportable based on the income of state residents? Both states say no. They point to the fact that, no, it's not sustainable. So you're right to point out that windfall should not be taken for granted, and people shouldn't be so optimistic that, you know, they should build in high amounts of spending.
Ms. Norcross, it's a pleasure to have you on, and thanks for putting this together. I know it's a little on the technical side, but I know a lot of my audience is going to want to go to the website at Mercatus.org, State Fiscal Rankings. One of the authors, co-author of Ranking the State's Fiscal Condition 2017 is Eileen Norcross, and we appreciate you taking the time tonight.
Thanks very much.
You bet. Glad to have you on. And glad to have you with me as well. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. I want to remind you, cybercrime is big business. It touches almost everyone. A recent FBI report says people across the country lost more than $1 billion to internet crimes and scams in 2015. Businesses that wire transfer payments showed the biggest loss, followed by romance fraud, and goods ordered online but never received, that was number three, with the highest number of victims at more than 67,000. Somebody's identity is stolen in America every 2 seconds. It can be stolen in ways you might not even detect if you're just monitoring your credit. Thieves could sell your information on the dark web or get an online payday loan in your name. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats. If there's a problem, U.S.-based identity restoration specialists work to fix it. Nobody can prevent all identity theft, nor can they monitor all transactions at all businesses. Act now and get the added protection of Norton Security free for the first year when you bundle Norton and LifeLock memberships. Plus, for a limited time, you'll also get a special 15% discount off the first year of service of your LifeLock membership. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or go to LifeLock.com and use promo code LARSON15. That's LARSON15 to save 15% today. Terms apply. Get LifeLock. I've had it for more than a decade. When we come back, we'll talk about New York's Mayor Bill de Blasio, who should have been in New York City mourning the death of a fallen officer instead of supporting protesters in Germany. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Naysayers go to the head of the line on The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday, live on the Radio Northwest Network, and glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You know, over the 4th of July weekend, I was gone for a bit. I took some time off with my family, but one of the major stories that I thought was a major story was the question of whether or not the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, should have stayed in New York to attend the funeral of a fallen police officer instead of traveling all the way to Germany to support protesters there. And I've invited James Fotis on the program, who's president of the National Center for Police Defense. James, it's good to have you back on the program. What should people make of this decision by one of the country's top Democrat office holders?
Obviously, Lars, we've seen Mayor de Blasio make a lot of random mistakes while he's been running New York City, and the more he makes, the more he drives his police officers away from doing the job that they're hired to do in New York. The New York City police need support. They need support of their Commissioner O'Neill. They need support of their mayor, and to have their mayor on a weekend when a hero police officer, Ms. Familia, was obviously executed in her car, and have him go to a protest, a protest that's against everything that New York City stands for, the capital of capitalism in America. You know, how could he possibly do that? And the Sergeants Benevolent Association came out against this this trip, and yet he still went on the trip, and he did not make it back for the vigil. And I'm not even sure if he made it back for the funeral. So, I mean, the mayor, I think he's going to have a very hard time getting reelected, and he certainly is not a favorite son of any of the police officers in New York City.
I mean, are we to make of this that he's just trying to position himself for something bigger? Because, I mean, the first thing I think of when I see major city politicians or governors is I think they may be auguring to run for, the Senate or to run for the presidency. Is that what he's doing, or is he just tone deaf to what his city is going to think when its mayor takes off to go to I guess they called it a nonviolent political demonstration against the G20 meeting of world leaders, and to visit his son who's living abroad. And he does that rather than stay at home and do what mayors are supposed to do when a city suffers a loss like this.
Exactly. It was, I think it was called the Hamburg Show's Attitude Rally. Well, they had, basically terrorists there. They were wearing black masks. They were destroying things. And here's the mayor supporting this rally and coming out in support of the police in Hamburg and not being home to support his own police officers. And it's just a shame that he's not where he's supposed to be. And as I said, he's never been a fan of police. He sent many of them for retraining, if you remember, after the big Black Lives Matter protest. And then, of course, we had the assassination of two other police officers in Brooklyn 2 years ago. And New York City police officers, they do a great job under Mayor Bloomberg and under the past mayors that have been there. And he is just destroying the police department, doing away with the major crime unit, the street crime unit, doing away with stop and frisk laws. He is driving the crime up in New York, and the police department is not doing the job that they are there to do.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about next. Where does New York sit right now? Because under previous mayors, the city actually saw a very big improvement in a reduction in crime and consequently an increase in the livability of the city as other mayors, going all the way back to Giuliani, drove crime down. And now he's adopted policies that seem almost intended to make the police disaffected and to make them less effective at doing their jobs, which can only mean bad news for the people who live in the city.
Exactly. You remember under Mayor Giuliani, they started the broken windows theory, where if there was a broken window, you made sure that you took care of that right away, or you wound up having 10, 20, 30 broken windows. They went into the bad neighborhoods, started the anti-crime units, and the crime went way down. Now we see crime going back up in the poorer areas of New York City, and that's just not good. If it starts in New York City, we see it starting again in major cities, and obviously everyone knows how serious the crime is in Chicago. But if the crime starts going up in New York, which has one of the major and best police departments in the United States, it's going to start going up again in L.A. and all of the other major cities. And there's nothing that we can do about it.
Well,
don't
some of those other cities take their cues about where to go with policing to some extent by the examples set by the bigger cities? So you've got the Seattles and the Portlands and the San Franciscos that look toward these leaders, and they're not leading.
Exactly. And it goes back again to chiefs of police being political appointees, following what these mayors, and many of them very liberal mayors, forcing them to push on their rank and file troops. And that's not good. And what's going to happen is police officers are actually afraid to go out in the street and do the job that they're being paid to do because they're afraid that the system's going to turn around and they're going to wind up being charged with offenses and wind up in court for the for trying to protect the citizens that they're there to protect. And that's what's been happening around the United States.
Well, and the reaction from the officers, I understand that, that even at the funeral, that hundreds of cops from this city who work for the mayor turned their backs, literally turned their backs on the man to send him a message about how they viewed his behavior.
Exactly. And I believe they had done that several times before at other police officer funerals, and they're trying to drive the message home that he is not doing his job and that he's certainly not supporting police officers. And all of these major city mayors have got to get together and get their facts straight and learn that police officers are out there to do the job and not to be reprimanded for doing their job, but to be supported by them.
Well, and then you've got this problem that this was another ambush killing.
Exactly. This one was obviously a it was an assassination. I mean, she was just sitting in her car and somebody walked right up and shot her. But if you remember, at the beginning of that week, there were two officers that were ambushed. I believe that was in Louisiana. And a couple of weeks before that, I believe there were two officers in Missouri that were also ambushed. So we have this going on throughout the United States. This is something new and something that definitely has to be stopped. And that's why I think it was Missouri that just passed the Police Officer Protection Act. And we're going to see hopefully more of these acts where if you try to assault a police officer, that it becomes a felony rather than a low-grade misdemeanor.
James, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for the work you do at the National Center for Police Defense.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
You bet. James Fotis with us. Back in a moment, your calls at 866-439-5277. Emails to talk at LarsLarson.com.